also happily give whatever notes that I have. You have an outline in front of you, which I hope you all got when you came on in, which just lets you know how close I am to the end. But I'm happy to give you the notes that I have if there's anything that you want. I come from outside of Boston, and so we learn how to speak very quickly up there. And so I'll try to speak at a slower pace for the rest of the world. I work for the Permanent Observer Mission of the Holy See of the UN. I've been here for 2.5 years. Prior to that, for 15 years, I was a pastor, a newspaper editor, a high school chaplain, and kind of a peripatetic retreat preacher and pilgrimage leader in the Diocese of Fall River, Massachusetts. I have an identical twin who's a layman that I know some of you were telling me downstairs you met at the Knapp Institute at CU last week. My twin brother is Scott. He's Harvard MBA, and he ran the finances for the Archdiocese of Boston for a while and has been involved as a layman in various Catholic projects. So if you happen to see me moonlighting without a collar, if you happen to see me with a marriage ring, or, you know, I really do have an identical I am honored to be asked to serve as the chaplain here. Actually, Mitch asked me the day I attended the funeral of Father Arnie Panula, who was really the founding inspiration of the Leonine Forum. And Arnie was always a good friend of mine, and when Mitch was asking me on that day, it was absolutely impossible to say no. But it's an extraordinary joy for me to be with you tonight to do this. I am really at your service for whatever you would need a priest for here in New York, whatever it be. Need a confessor who gives light penances, need a little bit of spiritual advice, have a question about this aspect of Catholic social teaching, wondering why Pope Francis said X last week and then not X the week after, or whatever the case may be. If that's what your question is, feel free to drop me an email. I've put on the bottom of your outline my email address as well as a cell phone number. Please keep that cell phone number to you. With reporters and everything else, I try not to get cold called with them. It's harder to lose them, and so that's for you. And if somebody's asking how to get in touch with me, please feel free to give the email, but the cell phone is for you. So tonight we're going to be talking in a half hour about Catholic anthropology and why it's relevant in the modern world. To do this in a half hour, you could skin it in many different ways. I'm going to go through this topic standing on the shoulders of St. John Paul II. We know that yesterday we would have marked the 39th anniversary of his election as Pope. And more than any other figure in church history, he has influenced my thoughts. I've read so many of his words, and it was at the formative time in my life where I recognized he had the central questions of the age, and I found his answers to those questions compelling. And so many of those answers and so many of those questions have no expiration date. And so I think if we're going to frame Christian anthropology facing the questions of the modern age, he gives us a very good perspective to do so. When he was preparing for the Second Vatican Council, there was an ante-preparatory commission in which the bishops who were going to be coming from around the world were asked to send in Latin, what they thought the council should cover. And so many of them were commenting on the schemas that had already been written up by Cardinal Ottaviani from the Holy Office at the age, etc. He wrote in something that I had the privilege to translate for George Weigel's Witness to Hope, which said that the most important thing the church needs to be doing is confronting the isms that were plaguing the human person in the middle of the last century. Not just Nazism and communism, but materialism, hedonism, individualism, relativism, atheism. He argued that modern men and women wanted to know whether Christian humanism was different from all the other humanisms out there, and whether the church had a plausible answer to the question of modern despair. Everything in the council, he argued, should be organized according to that framework. Now, that was a framework he was already working on. As a young chaplain at the Technical University in Krakow, as a young professor at the Catholic University of Lublin, he was confronting the lies of communism, the alternative answers to who the human person is, how the human person should behave. And first with secular categories accessible to everybody, and then inside in his chaplaincies with more specifically Christian arguments, he was trying to take the inheritance of the church, not just theology, but also solid philosophy, and confront it with human experience so that human experience can be illumined by the light of the gospel, by the light of reason, by the light of the gift that God had given. He had written several essays and a very important book on Christian anthropology, which he called Person and Act, in which he sought to sketch what he called an adequate anthropology. Anthropology, you know, is study of the human person. An adequate anthropology is an understanding of the person that, adequatio is a Latin word that means that corresponds to reality. And there were two senses there. First, an objective reality that corresponds to who the human person really is. And then to the subjective questions that men and women were having, that it would be compelling. It's not going to be, for example, a 13th century Thomistic treatment of the human person, because even though that might be true, it probably won't be as compelling to those who never were trained in scholastic categories. So we wanted it to be adequate in both senses. And he wrote this work, Person and Act. If you really want the Lenten penance, I would encourage you to read it. It's very, very hard. And the English translation for 75 years is very flawed. So for the most part, for us, you either get a copy of a bootlegged, solid English translation with the right category, or you have to read it in another language, Italian, Polish, etc. But in that work, Person and Act, he sought to describe this fitting Christian humanism, something that blended together both metaphysics, the study of reality as reality, and ethics, how we should behave. The person understood ontologically, and the person in action. The person is in his objective and subjective dimension, his exterior and interior reality. And he sought to do that with a philosophical method that he called phenomenological personalism, studying the phenomenon of the person in his relations as a person, his inward relations, his relations with others, his relations with his creature, his relations with his environment. This is what he wanted the church to do. He didn't persuade those in charge of the council to accept his ideas about framing the whole council in terms of Christian humanism. But he remained convinced throughout the council and beyond that the church needed this adequate anthropology, this fitting understanding of the human person, to propose to the Augustines of the modern world, who, like the Doctor of Hippo 16 centuries before, were seeking to find peace for their restless hearts in all types of false answers and dead ends. Wojtyla knew that their hearts would only be able to find rest in God, and he saw this authentic Christian humanism as the path to that fulfillment. While he didn't get the whole council framed according to this mindset, in the Pastoral Constitution of the Church in the Modern World, which you had as one of your readings, Gaudium et Spes, Joy and Hope, this was dedicated to the church's positive articulation of the gospel in response to modern anxieties. Now Archbishop Wojtyla during the council played an enormous role in the formulation of this humanism that oozes through the paragraphs. And it hinges, this Christian humanism, on two passages of Gaudium et Spes, which would become by far the two most quoted passages in his 26 years and 7 months as the 263rd year. The first passage is Gaudium et Spes 22, paragraph 22. You'll see the numbers there if you're not used to reading church documents. And the second is Gaudium et Spes 24. Gaudium et Spes 22 is a theological point. He says that Jesus Christ fully reveals the human person to himself and makes his supreme calling clear. That if we want to know who the human person is, we look to the person who was perfectus Deus, perfectus homo, perfect God, perfect man, undisturbed by sin. In two paragraphs later in Gaudium Spes 24, he makes a moral point based on that theological insight. He says, for the human being, human person to find fulfillment, he can only do so through the unselfish gift of himself to others. To frame it in a slightly different way, Jesus Christ is love incarnate. And what Wojtyla was saying is, in order to understand who the human person is, you have to understand him within the context of that identity. And then morally, person and act, the human person will find himself by loving like God loves, by giving of himself disinterestedly, unselfishly, for others. These were the two linchpins of his pontificate, bringing everybody to Christ, and then helping them to live in Christ in action. In his first book-length interview in 1993, Crossing the Threshold of Hope, St. John Paul II talked about how central this was to his work. He had said, I had long been interested in man as a person. Then, when I discovered my priestly vocation, man became the central theme of my pastoral work. He went on to describe how we needed to answer questions of young people about how to live, how to work, how to respond to the ism, and how that led to the deeper articulation of the personalistic principle, which was an attempt, he said, to translate the commandment of love into the language of philosophical ethics. The person is a being for whom the only suitable dimension is love. We are just to a person if we love the person. And love for a person excludes the possibility of treating the person as a mere object of pleasure. And then he mentioned Gaudium et Spes 24 and commented, here we have a truly adequate interpretation of the command to love. And at the same time, the council emphasized that the most important thing about love is the sincere, the truthful. When you hear sincere, don't think about sort of authentic meaning. Think about true. So, it cuts off falsity. We almost get the term sanctus from this word, sinceros, at the same time. It's cut off from falsity. Truthful, gift of self. So we're not faking it, we mean it. In this sense, the person is realized through love. Man affirms himself completely by giving of himself. This is the fulfillment of the command of love. It's also the full truth about man, a truth that Christ taught us by his life. And when he became Pope in 1978, 39 years ago yesterday, it took him a few months to put out his first document. His first document gave the program of his pontificate. And he entitled it Redemptor Hominis, Christ the Redeemer of Man. And he said the whole object of his papacy was to give a response to the fundamental question of how the human being could grow close to Christ as we approach the third millennium. To the question of who the human person is vis-a-vis Christ, we have to give, he says, a fundamental and essential response. We have to set our hearts in this direction. We need to set our minds, our will, and heart toward Christ, the Redeemer of man, to look toward him, to his life, to his teachings, to his incarnation, to his suffering and death, to the one who reveals himself as love. Goes on to a beautiful paragraph about how the human person can't live without love, and Christ shows that, and then he concludes. In reality, the name for that deep realization of man's worth and dignity shown to us by Christ's incarnation, his suffering, his death, all that Christ did for the human person, that deep amazement is the gospel. That's the good news. It's also called Christianity. And this amazement determines the church's mission in this world, and perhaps even more so in the modern world. But the church's mission in the modern world is to help the human person rediscover the amazement of who he is, with his dignity so affirmed by that crucifix. It also fixes, he says, Jesus Christ's place, his particular right of citizenship in the history of man and mankind and every man and woman. So in summary of this intro, the Church's mission in the modern world is all about this authentic humanism, to help the human person discover who he really is, to provide an answer to his deepest question, help him overcome the despair that sets in with nothingness or because of accumulated pains and suffering that no amount of psychobabble or booze can make disappear. The pursuit is clarified when one turns with wonder toward Christ and then looks in the mirror, who helps us to discover who we really are and shows us the path to true fulfillment, not through self-assertion, but through self-giving. So that was his whole project, and that's what I want as the introduction. The crucial importance of these questions and the pathway toward that answer in following the carpenter from Galilee. Let's describe some of the elements of an adequate Christian anthropology. And for that, I take these from the Compendium on Catholic Social Doctrine, Compendium on the Social Doctrine of the Catholic Church, which is going to be referred to in a lot of our fundamental sessions. It's for free online. I've reordered some of the points and tried to bring them out and giving, like an old high school chaplain, 10 coins. These aren't the only 10. These aren't necessarily the most important 10. They might not even be in the right ordinal rank for you, but these are things that we have to engage in adequate anthropology. First point, we're creatures. We don't create ourselves. We enter into life through the gift of another. And that brings about multiple relations. We're related to our Creator. We're related to our parents. That our nature starts with filiation. And that start leads us to participate in creation in a particular way. We'll see how many problems come when we forget that we're creatures. One of the exercises that you'll have over the table, you'll hear Pope Francis saying just 2 weeks ago that one of the biggest problems in the modern world is egolatry, that we worship ourselves because we forget our filiation to a father, our relation as creatures to a creator. Very, very relevant, and he'll sketch out exactly the consequences of what happens when we begin to make of ourselves a small g god. Second point, the person is fundamentally good. We've got that biblical account in Genesis. God said it was good, 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 and then finally with creation of the human person, very good. We need to recognize that essential goodness in ourselves and also in others. We must discover and respect our own and others' deep value. We have to rediscover, for an adequate anthropology, how to see that goodness in others, to see another as God sees that other and pronounce that other very good. You know, sometimes we can be really morally bad. But in terms of who we are, we're very, very good. Thomas used to always stress that even in hell, ontologically, we're good. Because we are created by God, pronounced good, even though morally we might be thoroughly corrupt. And sometimes the engagement with people is to remember in their presence what their goodness is and try to help that goodness grow. Third point. The person is one in body and soul. The traditional scholastic expression there is corpore et anima unus, one in body and soul. We are a union of material and spiritual realms. And both realms are good. Both realms are to be reverenced, neither to be despised. That a spiritualism and a materialism are both deficient. Probably the most common philosophical problem over the course of centuries that has led to the most common heresy has been Manichaeism, dualism, Gnosticism, etc. This separation that goes all the way back to Plato between the soul and the body. And many have thought that the soul was good, the body was to be despised. And that could lead to one of two extremes. If the body doesn't matter, do whatever you want with the body. Or, the Stoic alternative, because the body's bad, do everything that you can to escape from the body. We've got so many defective anthropologies today in which there's so much of an attack on the body. Some of it's psychological, some of it's even deeper than that, from the way that we treat our body. Everything from some of the ways the piercings and tattoos are done, in which there's to the cutting that takes place, and those who are giving physical expression of self-hatred in many cases, etc. There's this war against the body. The church says that the body is good. JP2's theology of the body was to try to reintegrate the goodness of the body. The human person has reason and will, we'll discuss that in a second, and emotions that we can feel, and that passions are fundamentally gifts but need to be ordered to truth and to good. We shouldn't be opposed to our emotions, to our feelings, but we have to integrate them. If we don't integrate them through reason and will, and we give them too much pride of place, we get to emotivism, which can create lots of ethical things, and we're living in an emotivist age. Fourth, the person is the image of God. What does that mean? It means several things over the course of time. That like God, we can know, we've got reason. But in knowing, we're bound to the truth of things. It's not just some assertion. The truth, in a sense that we know, we have a relationship with that truth now. Will, that like God, we can choose freely. Our freedom must be valued. But because of our creatureliness, our freedom's limited. Our freedom's bound, in a sense, to responsibility. If we're truly free, it's not the capacity to do whatever we want, whenever we want. But if we're truly free, when we make choices, we have to be loyal to them. It's bound to the good. It's bound to the truth. Last week, we hosted an event at the United Nations. And there was a Jewish sociologist there, very well known, who said something very beautiful in this interconnection between truth and freedom. He said, I say to my grandkids, as only a Jewish wise man could say, you can do whatever you want, provided that you do what you ought. That's real freedom. But the more we do what we ought, the more free we become. The more we follow our whims, the more we enslave ourselves. Freedom is not contrary to dependence on a creator. But in fact, that's a foundation for authentic freedom. Third part of the image of God is that we, like God, who is a communion of persons in love, we are called to communion in love. We're a social being with a social nature based on our relation with God. We're not solitary or atomized. We're called to live in society. And the gift of self leads to communion. John Paul II's theology of the body talked about the meaning of original solitude. That in a sense, there's always part of us that's incommunicable, that's mysterious, but that leads us to interpersonal communion. And that's built on in to the fact that we were created not just man, or not just man and man, or woman and woman, but male and female. In the image of God, he created not him, but them, because the communion of persons that we call a marriage, open a new life, is the greatest reflection on earth of a husband and wife capable of loving each other so much that their love can generate another person. Similarly, the human person made in the image and likeness of God is called to work. First command in the gospel came right after God called us into existence. Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion. And this was all before the fall. John Paul II talked about the gospel of work, that we see it right there built in to the book of Genesis. And it's through our work that we do two things. First, we transform the world. We make a desk. the transitive side of work. And then in the very process, we form ourselves, which is the intransitive, the subjective dimension of work. That if we do good work, we grow in virtue. If we do shoddy work, we hurt ourselves. Most of the Romance languages have this distinction. English, unfortunately, doesn't. Latin, for example, is facere and agere. We do something, facere. But in the very process of doing something exterior, we are remaking ourselves, agere, on the inside. St. Gregory Nyssa, the great 4th century Cappadocian doctor of the church, said, by our actions, we are our own parents. We form, in a sense, our second nature. If we're honest, if we always tell the truth, we make ourselves honest. If we're constantly ripping people off when we can get away with it, we're making ourselves a thief. That we do a similar thing in our work. John Paul II always stressed that work is meant to be an act of the person in which our real personality is there, and in work we imitate our creator. Fifth, there's an original differentiation between man and woman. The man and woman are equal in dignity, equally made in God's image and likeness, complementary biologically, metaphysically, and psychologically, but different. And this original differentiation is tied to the nuptial meaning of a person. That it's in that difference that we sense the call to communion. And so that when we tweak with who the human person is, male and female, and we pretend as if sex is gender, and gender is just a psychological state that's transient, we're really harming the person's capacity to relate to God long term, and it's ultimate, because God created original differentiation to help us on the exodus outside of ourselves toward another, and without that, when we start to lose that, that exodus through human love to being able to receive and reciprocate divine love doesn't happen as easily. And maybe not at all. Sixth, the human person has and seeks transcendence. We have a capacity for God. We're spiritual beings. We can get outside of ourselves into an I-thou relationship. Not just with those like us, but even our Creator. It's because of this transcendence that we can exercise dominion. While parts of us will always change, we're not, as Heraclitus said, constantly in flux. Because there is this transcendent part that remains. Seventh, Catholic social teaching always stresses that we have a conscience. What is a conscience? Literally, conscientia, cum scientia means to know with another. Cardinal Ratzinger, back in 1988, used a beautiful expression where he called it an inner organ of sensitivity. It's like an inner ear in which we are capable of hearing God's whisper, encouraging us to do something or not to do something, helping us to look at our past actions as well as the actions that we're facing right now. The judgment of the practical reason, taking the truths of faith and applying them to concrete circumstances to know what we should do or avoid. Conscience helps us to recognize that we're bound to the truth about the moral good, the way things are. It's not just heteronomous, binding us to a law outside of ourselves, but because it's been written inside, as we'll hear St. Paul say during this week if you go to daily mass, because it's written inside, it's also a law that's connatural with us. We don't create it, but it's there. It's not a violation of who we are. This leads to the eighth point. We're moral agents, capable of choosing good or evil, virtue or vice, holiness or sin. Virtue is anabolic. It builds us up spiritually to become more and more like God. It shows us that there's always possibility for growth. Sin and vice rip us apart, divide us within ourselves, and divide us from others and from God. Sin and virtue both impact our human nature. They help to form a second nature in us. Sin wounds our relationship with God, with others, with ourselves. There are clear social consequences to our sin. On the opposite side, good actions build us up and have a positive impact on our relationship with others. Ninth, and I'm sorry, I'm going fast. The person has inalienable dignity and inalienable rights that flow from that dignity. This dignity and these rights are given not by the self, not by the state, but found in our relationship to the creature and others. Gaudium et Spes, as you'll see, grounds it in two poles, our origin and our destiny. So we've been created in a relationship with God and called to a communion with God. This dignity goes beyond our functionality. The disabled still have this existential dignity. And human rights are an attempt to respond effectively to this human dignity. Those that are universal, inviolable, and inalienable, like the right to life or religious freedom, on the basis of which other rights form, are central and need to be defended if we're going to defend the person. And tenth, human person suffers and dies. There's a mystery of human suffering and death. In the fall, we see that the vocation of work that God had given now became arduous. There would be pain in the increase and multiply. There would be sweat and toil in the exercising dominion and in the subduing. Suffering and death are objective evils and subjective problems. But in the redemption, John Paul II stresses, they can become moral goods when they're received in communion with the Creator. We have to confront straight on the problem of physical, psychological, and moral pain and suffering. We can't duck the hard sight of the innocent suffering. Well, suffering and death remain mysteries. We do receive light in Christ, who fully reveals man and makes his vocation clear. We see on Calvary that suffering and death don't have the last word, that these ontological evils can become moral goods by the way we suffer and respond to other suffering. Salva Vici Dolores 29, which I know is not in your packet, but is really the money quote of that apostolic exhortation to 94. It said that the real purpose of human suffering is to unleash love in the human person. In two ways. First, seeing another suffering, we have got to make the choice of whether we're going to be a good Samaritan across the road, or whether we're going to care too much about ourselves and stay on our own side of the road. Thanks be to God, so many are formed by crossing to that bedside. Similarly, especially in an American context, we are rugged individuals. We'll say, no thanks, I don't need your help. I've got it from here, I can do it on my own. And when we suffer, sometimes we need somebody to just bring us a cup of water. Sometimes we need people to change our bedpan and sheets and clothes. That process of humility opens us up to the little acts of love that others give. And once we are open to being loved in this way, that's when love can likewise be unleashed in gratitude in the way, to use the modern expression, we can pay it forward. Let's just go through a few of the various anthropological issues before I get to your question. The first category of problems that we see today are what I phrase as reductionistic understandings of human anthropology. So it's not adequate. It only gets part of the truth. So what are some of them? At an ontological level, metaphysical level, materialism. We're just matter, we're just our chemicals. Thoughts are nothing other than neurological reaction. A lot of behavioral psychologists are materialists. Individualism, that we have no social nature.
It really is just survival of the fittest. Dualism, which is the notion of the disembodied self. I am my soul and that's it. It's the quickest I can escape, the better. But what I like to phrase is dehumanizing discrimination, like racism, which fails to recognize humanity in every human being. You can see the same thing in certain variants of terrorism, etc., that if you don't share the same religious creed or the same interpretation, you basically are the equivalent of someone who deserves to die. This type of stuff. Various reductionist understandings. Likewise, epistemological ones, relativism, that we just don't have confidence that we as human persons can know the truth, because there is no the truth. Gnosticism, that only certain people can know the most important stuff. Or you've got what I call Justice Anthony Kennedy, Casey versus Planned Parenthood, that at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, of the mystery of human life. That our will determines reality. An ethical reductionistic understanding. Moral relativism, that there are no moral absolutes at all, even if the person could know them. Emotivism, in which the chief ethical principle is the desire not to hurt another, the exaltation of another's feelings over the other's true good. Because sometimes, as any parent knows, you have to do something for the sake of a child's good that the child doesn't like. Or sometimes you're doing something really, you're doing something good that the person doesn't like, or you're doing something evil to a person that the person actually does like. A lot of the times that type of injury occurs all the time, especially in sexual sins today. Voluntarism, that everything is determined by whether our intention is good. At least I meant well, as if that can excuse really hurting somebody else. Next anthropological issue is problems with identity. That we think we define ourselves by pure will, contrary to the givens about who we are and about human nature. That we unshackle human nature from everything else to which it's connected. We self-identify. Now, Loretta Lynch said that to self-identify is a human right. Where does that come from? Rachel Dolezal claims that she was black. Where does that come from? And I once had a conversation with someone who was really trying to pepper with questions and say, they had asked some questions about gender identity and then about why women couldn't be priests. So I was starting to get in, well, who's really a woman if we're starting with that? And if you really want to go by your ontological categories, there's no such thing as woman. Well, then I'm the first woman priest, and now I'm the first former woman priest. And the person didn't catch the joke. You know, we don't self-identify. I'm not Pope Francis. I'm not President Trump. Neither are you. Eventually everything breaks down when we start to say pure will determines reality. There's a particular confusion with regard to love and human sexuality, because love has been reduced to a feeling rather than a commitment. No longer willing the other's good for the sake of the other, but it's willing the other for the sake of oneself, sometimes even for one's gratification. Love is no longer understood as a gift of oneself, that so many interpersonal relations feature mutual utilitarianism, or what J.P. Tu called harmonious egoism. And that's why in his Love and Responsibility he said that the opposite of loving is not hating. The opposite of loving is using, treating the other as a mere means to my own ends. And that leads to the severing of this connection between true love and sex, between sex and marriage, between marriage and children and family. So many of the gender identity issues have to do with sexuality.
to the one to whom, when one to whom one is attracted or with whom one acts out, is of one sex or another. There is this that can lead to confusion, especially when that person is of the same sex. For those with same-sex attractions, the church has done a very, very bad job on explaining the gospel, because very often the message that those with same-sex attractions hear is that the church says, you don't have a right to love. So what the church is saying, no, we want you truly to explode with philia and agape. But you also have to have chastity to make sure that your eros doesn't destroy your philia and your agape, your love of friendship and your love, your truly Christian love. Sometimes when they hear the term chastity, they think what it means is to lock them up lovelessly in a Vatican dungeon somewhere over the CDF. That's not what it is at all. We don't really proclaim the gospel of chastity in these contexts because many of the people don't understand even what it is, including Catholic priests and others. When we do chastity formation, a lot of the times in seminary, we're talking about celibacy. When we're doing it in high school, we're talking about abstinence. Chastity is a virtue to help us to love passionately. And John Paul II stressed that it's tied to three other virtues. Not fundamentally temperance, which is the traditional way of looking at it, but first to love. That chastity is tied to genuine love for someone, so that your attractions will be lifted up to the person's overall good, body and soul. Second, it's tied to purity, which is the way that we look at another person. Blessed are the pure in heart, they shall see God. That when we see another, we see a spark of God. St. Paul talks about that in Ephesians 5. Reverence one another out of reverence for Christ. And then purity leads to piety. We begin to reverence the other based on seeing the spark of God in them. Chastity has this huge positive content. Remember when I was at Harvard many years ago, I found a magazine there. We spent 19 months doing a double issue on homosexuality because it was really a homosexually predatory campus culture. It took us that long to really do a lot of the research and then to scrub it of anything that could possibly be labeled homophobic, because we didn't want the whole thing to go down the tank because of something like that. As a result of it, I did 35 one-on-one conversations with some of the brightest gays and lesbians in the Boston area. And they were very comfortable talking about their life. And I would ask them generally, when you engage in sexual activity, are you really doing it for the other or for yourself? Every single one said, well, I mean, it's totally consensual. We're both kind of doing it for ourselves, but the other's not getting hurt. We're not forcing ourselves on each other. But they were describing very clearly that when they were engaging in sexual activity, it was first for their own pleasure. And the church always says that when pleasure becomes the goal of the act rather than the fruit of the act, we begin to use each other for pleasure. And that's when whatever love is present, it begins to corrode rather than make a deeper bond, which is one of the reasons behind two sets of statistics. Why the more sexually active gays are in a relationship, the less the perdurance of the relationship, and same thing with couples who use contraception. It's the same type of thing. It changes the real meaning as pleasure becomes the goal and the other becomes the means. With work, many treat vacation as a norm of human life, rather than work is the norm of human life. We almost have a goal, an anthropological goal, that if we could retire at 45, let's do it. Well, not all bad, but what are we going to do with ourselves? How are we going to exercise our time when that comes? It's a huge issue of unemployment, especially for the youth. Pope Francis is constantly summoning the world's attention to this. Likewise, the problems for women's work. The women have been clamoring for decades about meaning in their work, to validate women's work. We haven't done an adequate job training the young with the virtues of work, making sure we provide work for the disabled. One of my first impressions when I came to New York was just how hard people work here. I never thought when I was a pastor in Massachusetts that I'd have to preach so many homilies about not collecting when you're not really injured. I had a 22-year-old art server come on in who had injured his hand. He had sprained his finger at Walmart where he was working, and he said, "My mother and my grandmother say, I think I can collect." I said, "Kyle, please." He wanted to go on 99 weeks of collecting because he had sprained his... But there was a mentality there that was against work that is based on a false anthropology. Study is obviously a part of that work, and we can see with some of the isms how they got work wrong. Communism obviously got work wrong because it was based on socialistic stuff in which we didn't see authentically man's freedom. Likewise, capitalism, when it's so focused on money rather than on the agents, it likewise can get off. And then finally, suffering. The huge suicide epidemic that we have because people don't know how to deal with pain. The opioid epidemic. And they no longer see meaning in suffering and pain. We begin to treat human beings like we do pets and just euthanize them. But once we open the door to voluntary euthanasia, it changes the entire approach to suffering. And it very quickly, as we've seen in various countries in Europe, leads to involuntary euthanasia. On the flip side, it points to the importance of palliative care, the key of compassion, making sure people don't suffer alone, and allowing others' love to be unleashed when we're suffering rather than robbing them of their growth and humanity. When I talk to people at the very end of life, they always consider themselves such an extraordinary burden that even though they've changed their kids' diapers for years, they don't think that their kids should have a chance to return the favor. We have to help people to become humble enough to allow others to love them because we're actually doing those others a favor and helping them become more human. So in some, there's a need for an adequate anthropology, adequate in itself that corresponds to the data, an adequate in persuasion that corresponds to the question. Ideas are obviously important, but it must be lived. And we're called to become an answer to the problem of the need of an adequate anthropology. One of my favorite spiritual aphorisms is St. Francis de Sales, who used to say, "Soyez vous-même," be yourself, be yourself. And we've been made in a particular way. Jesus himself says, "The one who is perfect is homo, follow me." John Paul II instantiated this. He was so rich in humanity. He's a poet, playwright, philosopher, theologian, athlete, baritone singer, Christian. We start off with anthropology tonight because it's obviously central to everything that we're trying to do with the Leonine Forum. And the forum seeks ultimately not just to inform, but to help form us in this type of adequate anthropology. And thanks for embarking on that journey. We've got about 5 minutes for questions, and then I think we can go downstairs. So I went a little bit longer than I was intending. Are there questions initially? Clarifications? Arguments? Yes.
Thanks so much. On conscience, one thing I always struggle with when I think about conscience is how do you separate it from any other voice? Could be neurosis, could be something you grew up with. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, in the moment, maybe, I guess you can always go up against the compendium or scripture or the catechism, but in the moment,
sure. Oh, it's a great question. We've got competing voices sometimes within. A lot of people are confused that they think that conscience is their gut instinct, others who think it's their opinion about the way things ought to be in a particular circumstance. Others just don't know if that voice is coming from God. The difficulty in conscience when we've got a gut-wrenching decision is as we're trying to apply, even if we're doing it only informally, the principles that we know to a concrete act, we don't know which of those principles is actually more important to apply in a lot of cases. And so the church generally recommends a few things. First, studying the question. You know, sometimes the art of casuistry, getting gets a bad rap because it wasn't sufficient in and of itself, but a lot of the times the questions we have been discussed before and engaged in, that's always a place to consult. We should take it always to God in our prayer and listen as carefully as we can to the insights the life also wants to give us within. To the extent that there are authoritative sources of the church, that we study them and engage them and see if they give light. Church says that normally we should go to people who have got reputations for thinking with God's thoughts and being able to communicate that, spiritual directors, confessors, priests, professors, etc., depending upon what the circumstance is, to ask their light in sorting through the rank of some of these principles and the application to the circumstances. Those are ways that we, those are the sort of first answer that we can go. Sometimes we just really have to struggle. And when we get to that struggle, especially in areas in which the church hasn't defined something. So let's just take one. You're a married couple. You know, you've got all these frozen embryos out there. Can you adopt one to save one's life? Church hasn't formally pronounced. It's tended in the answer to say, no, don't do it. But it hasn't really said it yet. So a couple in prayer might look at a circumstance like that and say, saving that embryo's life is such a high value that we're going to do it. Another couple might say no on it because we should only be conceiving a child in an act of love between the two of us, not with the help of some third party and everything else. It's still a question in which couples conscientiously could go in either direction. What would be a good way to make a decision like that? A good way to decision, lots of prayer, not rushing, talking to some others, especially those who might disagree with the conclusion, right? Just so that we're really being tested and working through. Consulting dignitas personae, which came out from the church, which tends in one direction, but it doesn't really say that it can't be done absolutely, etc. Look at some of the scholars writing on both sides and just make sure that the decision is ultimately purified as much as we can from what I'd call a willfulness, in which we're really sort of leaning at an emotional or at the level of our will in one direction or another, because that sometimes can be opposed to the will of God, and so we want to bring it into alignment. That's where it starts. With the answer to the question. Thanks for the good one. Yes?
Considering the adequacy of these principles in terms of persuasion, the one that strikes me as the hardest to present to, say, a non-Catholic would be the distinction between freedom and license. And how have you found, what are useful ways you found to communicate that difference that goes beyond the piano example of, like, you could hit any keys you want on a piano and make a lot of noise, or you could, in a disciplined way, produce some Mozart by following the rules. How do you illumine that difference in ways that are persuasive?
So I generally try to do it in two ways. First is I point to people who live freedom united to the truth. And I point to others who live according to whatever their whims be or their pleasures be. Normally when you do that with people that this person identifies, they'll see clearly in most cases that they want to be like one rather than the other. You know, for me, for a lot in the U.S., I just ask, do you really want to be Hugh Hefner? Do you think that he's really free? And then I just oppose it to some other person who lived virtuously. And that would clarify in a lot of these circumstances. Sometimes that wouldn't work. The second general approach is I would help them to understand the relationship between freedom and the truth by context like communism, and in the communist countries where your capacity to live the truth was robbed from you. Because sometimes that's what that's where I think JP2 got this type of clarity, because they were not able easily to live the truth publicly in Poland, because that capacity to follow one's conscience, all the rest, live according to the truths of the church, in many ways that was prevented. Now you could always have interior acts in alignment with it, but when it's stolen from you, I think people can more easily see by that parable of communism here in the States what this connection is. If you talk too theoretically,
if they've got an issue with relativism in general, that there's my truth and your truth, but not the truth, as George Weidel likes to say, they're not really going to get that example. But if you take away something that they know is a good, that's when they can see a little bit more clearly. And so I try to flip them to the real enemies. And so the real enemies are people who genuinely have taken people's freedom away, not the church, who is saying that what you need to do is use your freedom in this direction. And, you know, I also think that we have to sever the connection historically in the church of the way that we argued morally by guilt-tripping people. That if you do this, you will go to hell. Now, it might have been mortally sinful, and that objectively may be true and the whole rest of it, but I think the heritage of this was to get people to fear the truth rather than love the truth. And so when we go to circumstances where truth was robbed, I just think it clarifies a little bit more easily for people to rebuild their understanding of the truth as a good rather than as a threat. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Is that it? Okay. So tomorrow, listen to me. We've got these questions. I would just urge you at your table to take one of them. You're not going to have the chance for all of it, and maybe you could consider the other four part of your homework. These were all taken from one speech of Pope Francis 2 weeks ago, and I think you will see in what he describes the relevance of what we're talking about tonight. Thanks, everybody.